Welcome to the Stingify podcast. I'm Thomas Morris, contributing editor for Stingify, and I'm joined today by Danny Denton. Hailing from Cork, Danny is a longtime contributor to the Stingify, whose work first appeared in the magazine's pages back in 2007. The recipient of several bursaries and scholarships for his writing, Danny has published fiction and non-fiction in Granta, Southward, Funhouse, and The Tangerine. His acclaimed debut novel, The Early King and the Kid in Yellow, was published earlier this month by Granta Books. Hi, Danny.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for having me.
It's lovely to have you here. What are you reading for us today?
I'm reading Show Them a Good Time by Nicole Flattery.
Can't wait to hear it.
Show Them a Good Time by Nicole Flattery. The schemes were for people with plenty of time, or people not totally unfamiliar with being treated like shit. I was intimate with both situations. Management interviewed me. Bizarre questions through an inch of plexiglass. How long in hours have you been unemployed? Did you misspend your youth throwing stones at passing cars? This can be a tangential process, management explained, and I said sorry. Only peasants apologize, management stated, and returned to her obscure markings. The interview was an all-nighter, designed to break my spirit and ensure I pledged organization and responsibility for the rest of my days. I emerged from it, not completely sure of anything except my own name and my age, which I knew was somewhere in my late 20s. In the morning, I was taken to the bathroom to be measured for a uniform. The toilet stall had the dark, depthless feel of a place where a body may have lain undiscovered for days. The shirt gave me breasts. The regulation boots gave me legs. All those parts I had worked so hard to forget were now reunited under surprising polyester circumstances. When I was dressed, management offered me a manic thumbs up. Management was round, almost perfectly so, and given to spontaneous bursts of laughter. She looked at me, at my white and empty face, and asked, "Isn't it a great thing to be able to give yourself a giggle?" I saw in that gesture her former life as a farmhand, the crazy ease with which she sent animals off to be slaughtered. Management explained the procedure again. Our function was to be near the till, maintain the presence of the garage, and, most importantly, believe. Management left the room as I screened the demonstration video. In it, three participants with the sexless good looks of catalogue models spoke of the joy of being back at work. Whenever they did something spontaneous or something considered outside their remit, a large X popped up on screen. As I watched, I felt giddy and ashamed, as if I were witnessing a particular type of vicious pornography. Management suggested if I ever feel like I didn't believe, I should go for a short, furious walk, maybe up and down the motorway path, and stay away from my colleagues, as my attitudes and sulky face could be hazardous. She said I seemed like a nice person, and if we had customers, they would probably like me. I had a personality that was best suited to short interactions. "Should I get a business card made?" I asked. "It's something to consider," management said, and she repeated her manic thumbs up. Before the garage, my hometown was famous amongst people with car sickness. It was here they stood retching and spewing before moving on somewhere better. When I came back from the city, I thought we might both have changed in bright and glamorous ways, but we hadn't. We were both long acquainted with disappointment and the joys of being used. I'd been home 2 months and the house felt strangely empty to me, as if all our furniture had been sold. Somehow, 100 tiny unspeakable events had happened in my absence. I was reunited with my mother, two flirts, two women who might find themselves in abusive relationships and not even notice. Two true suckers back together. Every dinner time she questioned why I ate the way I did, why I stuck my fingers in so many jars and rooted around. Did I eat vegetables at all? Did they serve peas in many restaurants in that city? I said I didn't know. It wasn't something I thought much about, and she pointed her fork at me, that absurd vegetable speared on it, as if we shared a private joke. Were there boys there? Did you have a boyfriend? I did. Was he nice? Not really. He was irritating, you know. He said things like, I will have a small espresso. Stuff about coffee that people already just know. He wasn't funny at all. And he kind of hit me sometimes in my sleep. Though I suppose I was just pretending to be asleep, so it wasn't totally honest of me either. It's important for a man to have a sense of humour. A confiding, motherly smile. Her optimism was of the terrifying, impenetrable variety. It could burn through entire periods of history. I lay on my lumpy bed and dreamt up inventive ways of leaving my own body. I looked at it, slack, star-shaped, and closed my eyes, reopened them, still there. It didn't seem to be going away. I made lists of things I cared about, things I did not care about. One of these lists was always significantly longer than the other. I was restless. I made many visits to the rain barrel in the yard. I felt the rain barrel was a measure of time, all the rain collected in my 2-year absence. My mother sensed the world might run out of water, and this cracked aluminium barrel was our security, our secret plan. I wanted to say, it's the 21st century. But it sounded self-important and foreign in our hostile little house. I had no interest in redemption. I didn't believe in it. It was for crackpots, squares. But something about that rain barrel made me want to be reborn. I could see myself sailing through the murk, the dirty leaves framing my face, the blueness of the barrel bringing out my inner Virgin Mary. It was necessary for me to get out of the house. Kevin arrived on the job exactly 1 week after me, but immediately possessed an understanding of the garage that I lacked. He grasped its quiet romance, its rusty appeal. He knew the order we were meant to do our activities in. It was innate. It was perhaps something he was born with. I might put the mop in the bucket, or I might wring out the mop, and he would say, we are not supposed to do that part yet. And he would be right. He worried about my non-linear mind, but I felt we worked smoothly as a perfect, synchronized team. I liked him far more than was strictly encouraged. I knew management wanted us to have more of a difficult relationship, with maybe a frisson of grim sexual tension, but it didn't happen. From the beginning, we shared a special atmosphere, a private connection that was pure and honest. For instance, he knew immediately when I was in the bathroom checking my face to see if I was still up to scratch, that all the waiting around hadn't ruined me. He didn't hate me for it. We both shared dim dreams of self-assertion, fantasies where we fought and emerged triumphant. We trusted each other. We made confessions. I was probably the sister he wanted to marry. As an older woman, I felt it necessary to encourage his self-esteem. I told him that he looked incredible in his uniform, that it did wonders for his lanky 19-year-old frame. That was true. He looked like something out of a movie about bandits or serial killers on the run. Except he wasn't a bandit or a serial killer. He was the gas station attendant who pointed helpfully and said, "They have gone that way." He enjoyed these comparisons, these tokens. He admitted, as we swept the garage forecourt, as we kept our eyes peeled for lucky pennies, that in his mind, everything was television. There were ways of separating reality from fantasy, but he did not know them. This could be a minor problem, like having trouble with directions, confusing north and south, or it could be a major problem. Once, as we weeded the area around the rude, unnecessary fence, he told me he felt like a character being awkwardly written out of a sitcom. You know, when they are there but they don't do or say anything, like nobody has a clue what to do with them. Then they disappear and not a single person even bothers to mention it. That is happening to me, I think. I was familiar with numb feelings of this type. In the garage, I felt like anyone could step in and play me, if they were supplied with the correct expression of anguish, the sluggish reactions of someone baffled by their own poor choices. Often, in the evenings when self-pity set in, talking seemed like a good idea. I would say, "Talk to me, Kevin," and he would oblige. Kevin's cinematic knowledge was both detailed and absurd. It left slim room in his brain for anything else, but I was grateful for it. It eased the spectral silence of the garage. I liked to make a big show of listening to him. I think it made him feel better. Like he had done more than mark a time card, weed the yard, wait. I wanted to impress him. It was just something in the air between us. You know, I did some films. Small parts, but I was on set. Both of us perfectly unmoving in the motorway breeze. "What was it like?" he asked. Like everything else after a while. Almost boring. Unpleasant. A lot of hanging around. "Is that why you left?" "Yeah." And all the good roles started drying up. "Oh, that happens," Kevin agreed earnestly. "I have heard of that happening to women." Within a few weeks, I developed a nightly routine of walking briskly, guiltily past the house where Kevin still lived with his father. I did not like the conclusions I came to. I could picture him inside, folded over his single bed, staring intently at a screen. Some mornings, I could imagine a faint trace of a television glow on his body. Back at the garage, I was in charge of the interior. It contained three tin cans of indiscernible origin, one for each shelf. A feeling of forever melancholy, a postcard of a skyscraper, and a ghostly fridge floating in the middle of the floor. We talked about painting the walls. Painting, stock, customers. Kevin had the schemes and the mindset of a helpless idealist. As regards love and friendship, I sometimes got the sense it was a bit of a one-way street with Kevin. He was embarrassed by my cluelessness, and this brought out a red, rough rash on his cheeks and an unattractive side. "I slowed him down," he said. "I held him back from his advancement in his field," he said. Blah, blah. He had a habit of pointing out my less than quick wits in the mornings. He pushed out his hands, rolled back his eyes, and staggered in my direction. I was his zombie wife, his zombie sister. He added, in a polite and helpful way, that there are ways of mixing things so you don't get formidable hangovers. "Don't you want this place to be nice?" he shouted at me. "I do." I certainly did. They could have given us more than three cans of godforsaken soup. We don't know if they are soup. What I mean is, that they're not even putting in a bit of effort. In the training offices in town, they have two working computers. What do we have? I double-tapped the postcard. There was possible room for promotion at the garage, and that possibility nearly drove Kevin demented. I was done with trying. There was nothing to do, and I didn't feel like doing it. Just stay alive. That was my job. But Kevin was starving. Management knew just how to send him sky high with outrageous promises and complete lack of follow-through. I said it was tacky to want to succeed at an imaginary job. I liked to be honest when I felt it was needed. Kevin said he wished I paid the same level of care and attention to everything in the garage as I paid to the plant, which I watered daily. The plant had been introduced in the summer as a new level of responsibility, and it quickly became our incredible object. It was the sole living thing in our stockless gloom. It was green, as plants usually are, but it had a touch of the exotic about it. It was in my interest to keep it out of the sun and away from the greedy birds. "Stop cuddling the plant," Kevin often suggested. "I'm just holding it," I lied. I liked to have it in my hands. my fingers wrapped delicately around its black plastic casing. If pushed, I probably would have admitted to some feeling of kinship with the plant. There were hundreds of things we didn't understand about the world, and there wasn't a person alive interested in telling us. Poor short and squat fellow. Kevin blamed my passivity for our slow days. I was a human scarecrow, a strange woman, wild-haired with end-of-the-world eyes. What town could not turn away from that? Despite his calm exterior, he was capable of great crabbiness. He screamed questions at the blameless sky. He shook the petrol pumps as if he alone could outwit their emptiness. "We must be profitable," he said to nobody in particular. "Why do you move like that?" he asked once. "It's a walk I'm trying. It's only recent. Do you like it?" "It honestly looks like there is something wrong with you." "There is something wrong with me," I said. "When I was a child, I grew at an advanced rate. My mother took me to the doctor to measure my arms and legs, and they're actually 2 inches longer than they should be." I had ways of silencing Kevin, ways of forcing him to stare rigidly into the distance, as if being near me required huge strength. He was a young person given to habitual fits of insanity and nervy implosions. I passed several weeks simply following his erratic, slippery shadow through the glass as he stalked the garage floor. He needed to get over his moods, sharpish. But I worried for Kevin. I did. I worried about people desperately. It took up a huge amount of my daily hours. I didn't ask to be that kind of woman, but that's just the way it worked out. The reason I ended up in the garage was clear. I was being punished in a sluggish, work-shy way by the universe. And honestly, it just made me laugh. "Why are you here, Kevin?" I asked. My dad said even a clown could do it. Occasionally, when people from out of town arrived in, rumpled and made frantic by too much time with their families, I became shy. There were probably interesting things to talk about and ways to make the garage understood, but these people possessed an energy that was beyond me. I was skittish. I sweated unnatural amounts. I went unusual hues. The people moved at a ferocious speed. They had their grand intentions: conversation, sucky sweets, inexpensive petrol. I felt like a child trapped in a dumb plastic playhouse before these adults. Forever dutiful, I stuttered through my spiel. "Thank you for visiting us today. I'm sorry I can't help you in any way, as this establishment is a participant in the practice scheme designed to improve my skills and eventually lead to long-term employment." "I know what you are thinking, but you would be wrong. Please take a complimentary mint." The mints were my idea, and I always pushed the bowl towards the customers in what I hoped was a cordial way. These people had a habit of looking right through me, so it was not unusual for me to go completely silent and turn stiffly away from them. I could still feel them behind me, their impatience growing, breathing, becoming lethal, but I never looked around. My frozen back said it all. I returned to tending the plant or standing stupid still with my hands resting on my thighs. Had there been a panic button, I would have pressed it. Kevin beamed at them as they left. Kevin said the unique service experience dug straight into a customer's soul. It was something to do with the correct measure of eye contact and unobtrusiveness. Afterwards, he tended to lock himself in the toilet stall for half an hour. He may have been punching things and missing, or not missing, I didn't know. Usually, he would emerge in obvious despair and accuse me of being antisocial. I was not being my premier self, so he was correct in that sense.
Thank you, Danny. That was a wonderful reading. I suppose I should first acknowledge for listeners at home that that wasn't the entire story. It's a long story, it's 8,000 words, so we probably would have been here most of the day had you read it in full. So just for people listening at home, if you want to read the full story, you can read it on the website. To date, Nicole has published two stories and a personal essay in The Sting and Fly, and she's published a number of other stories in equally esteemed journals. I'm wondering, what is it that draws you to work in general, and specifically, I suppose, why did you choose this particular story today?
Well, it was a really interesting exercise to think about, you know, what, almost 20 years of The Sting and Fly, and to think, right, I can pick one story. And my first thought was to delve deep into the archive and come up with something, from the very back of the vault. Mm. But as I was making lists of names of things that jumped straight to mind and looking through the archive, I thought of Nicole and this story in particular, Show Them a Good Time, I couldn't think beyond anything else. Mm. Probably, I think, because it feels to me, and it felt to me when I first read it, so utterly strange and different and fresh. Mm. And singular, especially for an Irish writer. And I think, that's probably... and then once I had thought of it, nothing else seemed anywhere near as important. And it was always that one then.
Yeah, I remember when I first read that story, that sense of strangeness and freshness was something which really hit me across the face, really. I'm just wondering, how has the story changed for you since first reading it? I reread the story last night, and it feels like a very different story to me now.
Yeah, and we're looking at each other's notes, and they're covered in, like, each time I go back to it, there's more to add or a different way to think of it. One of the things about great literature in general, and it's kind of maybe an obvious cliche, is that it works on several levels. And I felt reading this for the first time, it struck me as this intensely personal thing. But at the same time, I couldn't possibly have understood what was intensely personal about it. I was able to understand this general feeling about it. So I was reading it almost split in two reading it. Mm. And I think great literature really does that. It works on two levels or more. And so when I was reading it, I was kind of picking up this really interesting indirect way of confronting trauma and loss of kind of self. Mm-hmm. And then I was also picking up this very general thing in my own head that I have this massive problem with things like job bridge schemes. And it's working on these two levels. And the indirectness of it. So there's something going on in the prose where, you know, you never ever stare at the problem. You're always glancing at it. Like even I think there's a line about the sky is kind of glanced at briefly. Things are kind of written in roundabout ways. There's a lot of human resource language that deflects you from the core, you know, massive kind of sadness or pain in it. And it's just once you've read it, the first time at least, once I've read it, that was all I got. Like I just came away from the story with this, whoa, what just happened? And then you go back to it again and you see a whole other quality to it, perhaps that more general quality of this actually speaks for a generation. You can take the personal side out of it and it can speak for a generation of people who are kind of lost and wandering and seeking out their selves.
Do you think that's a specific to this generation? Because reading the story, I felt like the internship aspect was very specific. Mm. These job bridge schemes, you know, the story had to take place within the last 10 years, per se, but it also speaks to perhaps the general experience of work. And
yeah, so that's a hard one to answer, you and me being from the same generation and not probably knowing another generation. But so one of the things about that is there's an idea. I'll try and avoid the word millennials, right? Because it comes with all sorts of other baggage, right? But there's an idea. People roughly your age and my age, somewhere between, say, 25 and 35, something like that, we had all this choice. And that choice kind of seems to have fogged us somewhat. And we can give out about that all we want, but we had loads of choice, and that's a good thing. And other generations, you get the sense that they had less choice and it was about use. You had, what was your purpose? What was your use? It was to be
a mechanic, a chef, this, that, the other, a teacher. And I got a little bit of this when I went to secondary school. We had our career guidance teacher who said, you're good at English, you'll do law. You're good at maths, you'll do engineering. And Ireland was made of lawyers and engineers all of a sudden. So there's a sense of, maybe it's the same for every generation, but there's a little shift. And the little shift for us is that when you're given, like there's a great line in this about the character goes and meets, she goes and meets her friends who didn't. So the character left the town, went to the city for a couple of years, came back and all her friends were still there. They hadn't gone. And they said something about you went away to find yourself. And they were all the friends are kind of jealous because they stuck around and paid their motorway tolls, yeah. Right? But the sense that you get from reading the story is that the narrator who went away to find themselves, found nothing, came back, and there's lots of lines, there's lots of lines in this about wanting to be someone else. Like, yeah. I wanted to be so many other people, but I'm stuck with myself. And there's a big empty hole where that self is. And I feel like that's a problem of people our age, maybe because we're aware of so many choices and we're aware of the idea of going away to find yourself is so easy for us. Like you can do your gap year, right? And what are you supposed to find in 1 year? Who knows? Whereas maybe it was this, you know, that kind of silly cliche, like there were simpler times. Maybe earlier generations, there's less of a choice. Therefore, they maybe got on with what they had. What their use and purpose was, and I use that in a kind of ironic or derogatory sense, their use and purpose for society was more laid down, and you know, maybe that's different generational problems arose in those generations, whereas now we see this story in particular seems to identify a crisis of the self, and I certainly identified with that when I read it.
Yeah, this question of the self. And earlier you mentioned when you first read the story, you felt the story felt personal. I was listening to last month's podcast with June Caldwell, and she's talking about the Claire Louise Bennett story and describing the point of view that Claire Louise Bennett adopts in that story. She called it close first person, which is a beautiful phrase I hadn't heard before, but to describe that kind of intimate psychological interiority. And this is a first-person story, and it feels personal in some way, but I can't help feel that there's some kind of distancing going on as well, that the narrator isn't telling us everything, but she's keeping us, the reader, at a...
absolutely.
At an arm's reach in some kind of way. Is that what you feel?
Yeah, absolutely. And there are then a few glimpses... Oh no, glimpse is the wrong word. There are then a few sudden turns where she looks you full in the face,
yeah.
And you just... it's like quite emotional. I think there were times where I still almost kind of choke up reading it aloud.
Yeah.
But the indirectness is really interesting because that's a craft issue. And I think it's really important to talk about, this isn't just a good story because it's a good symbol of something.
Yeah.
This is damn fine writing at a craft level. And so one of the things, and I tried to make a list of these, one of the things about the language of the piece, the register of the piece, is it starts as a scheme, right? I think the second word is the schemes.
Yeah.
And all of a sudden you're in this, your register is the register of human resources. Now, let's take the phrase human resources and the horror of that phrase, human resources, put it aside for a second. And words like disclosed, tangential, it was necessary to, this passive tense, I'm not totally unfamiliar with, rather than saying I'm used to.
Yeah.
That kind of language, everything is suddenly at one remove.
Yeah.
All the facts you're told, all the feelings expressed are at a remove, so you never get to see them clearly. And that kind of human resources language, you know, again, I'm just like unique service experience, low opinion, best qualities. These are all interview words.
Yeah.
And she paints the whole story with them. And then what you're left with is this kind of, I can't get close to this person, but I feel like there's this massive black hole in the middle of this.
Yeah.
And then you get a few glimpses of real emotion, a sentence, maybe there might be five sentences in the whole piece where you can tell that the real me, here I am, turns to face you. And that's what really, that's what really gives the story probably its emotional depth. It's also where humour comes from, a lot of these glimpses, this sideways glancing of language, which is like just so, you know, we're both writers, it's so hard to do that well.
That language that you talk about, that kind of job speak, it put me in mind of some of your own stories. I know that you kind of like to explore kind of the role of work on us as people, about kind of dehumanising aspect. But I wonder in this story, is it the job that is distancing the person, the narrator, from herself? Or is it also something else? Is it her past, or is it a combination of both? Is it too easy to
go on? No, so I think this is where we go back to the story, working on it on a couple of levels. So it feels clear to me now after a few readings, and obviously, you know, you can never know for sure, but the reader finishes the work, so I'm right anyways. This personal story, the I, goes to the city. It is not what she expected. Trauma happens. You know, there's these horrible lines. He kind of hit me in my sleep, but I was only pretending to be asleep anyway. So there's this violence underlies everything. Like at every page, there's some little indicator or implication of violence. You know, even in the parents' kind of sharp tones and things. Yeah. And obviously then you, as the story goes on, you come to these clearer instances of violence, domestic abuse. And for me, it seemed, when I was kind of trying to think about how I would talk about this, it seemed to me that the loss of self in this personal story is down to trauma.
Yeah.
That she goes away, to find herself perhaps, and is a victim of this massive traumatic experience, and that completely obliterates the self, right? Mm. There's a line about her, the abusive boyfriend, he possibly didn't even know my name.
Yeah.
So she's literally, her name is taken away, her body is taken away. You know, there's lots of stuff in this about the body, and the body is completely detached from the I, right? As in the letter I. Mm. And so that to me seemed very, very personal. And perhaps in that way, this is a story about how trauma can obliterate your sense of yourself. And she comes home to slowly work back to it, and she ends up in this scheme, this HR language going on, these friends who don't really understand her anymore. And she's trying on different selves all the time. She's trying on a walk. She's trying on the image of having a job. It's not even actually a job. It's not even a functioning garage, so on that level, I think that certainly there's a trauma that obliterates the self. Then on the, if you were just to take it as this is a story about someone on a job registry and they're completely dehumanized by it, that works on a less emotional level. That works as well. And that is meaningful as well, I think.
So do you think that in a way it's those feelings are feeding into the kind of irrealism or the surrealism of the story? And I'm never quite sure what word to put on the mode that Nicole Flattery's stories often work in. but as the story progresses and reaches the ending, there's a moment which kind of goes beyond realism, perhaps. And there's that great line earlier where Kevin said that there are ways of separating reality from fantasy, but they weren't necessarily available to Kevin. So there's a story that plays with these questions. And
absolutely. I wanted to say at some point, this might be the point, that when I read Nicole Flattery's work, I get a real sense of what happens to me when I watch David Lynch.
Yeah.
In that you are watching real things, and you're witnessing real things with depth and meaning. But there's, I want to say a dreamlike quality, but that's too simple. It's a feeling.
Yeah.
And the really interesting thing about this story is it takes very commonplace things. It takes the garage, like it's the outpost of every town in Ireland, the garage. It takes the motorway, something we're used to existing on. It takes film. It takes things in the everyday, and it gives them this bizarre otherworldliness. Mm-hmm. And I think part of that is the choice of a garage, because a garage is kind of a place, but it's not a place. It's a non-place. It's somewhere you pass through very quickly. So you're taking it into a kind of a transient place. And I think probably it's really hard to actually try and put words on this.
Yeah.
But I think having it in that transient, otherworldly space, and having the character being so detached from you, you do then end up in this surreal place in your head. This is all happening in a town. There's no dispute about that. It's happening on a garage forecourt. But you feel like you've been transported somewhere. And perhaps it's something, she doesn't use a lot of time markers. You're never really sure. And that probably adds to this dreamlike quality. Suddenly you're laying in the bed. Suddenly you're back at the garage. So perhaps that it all combines to give you that feeling, that surreal feeling, even though you're grounded in reality.
And even in that opening, I think the narrator says, but she's not even quite sure of her own age.
Yeah. So she says, I told them I was my age or something like that, which I think was in my late 20s. I was certain of one thing, which I think. And I guess when we talk about it as a feeling as well, that's probably what trauma is like. You know, that kind of everything is very real, but at the same time, you can't accept it. Mm. You don't, this isn't happening to me. You know, and perhaps there's like, you know, the craft, the amazing craft and long craft that's gone into this. It builds up to that, to matching the feeling that I presume that she wanted the reader to have.
Yeah. One of the things I think this detachment that you're talking about, it lends to a great humour in the work as well. And John McGregor, writing The Guardian about Nicole Flattery's story Track, described it as a very funny and very sad story, but written in a misleadingly offhand deadpan. Now, I don't know, is that something that chimes with you? How would you characterise the humour
I think that probably sums it up better than I can, actually. And I know we kind of had a brief chuckle about the reading of it, because when you read it, it's overwhelmingly sad, and it's very difficult to get the humour that is clearly there in the lines. Mm. How she does it, that's a really tough question to answer. It's something I struggle with in my own work, in trying to be funny. No, it's not trying to be funny, actually, is it? It's sidestepping the sadness for a second, or taking the tragic one step further. Maybe that's what it is. She has a lovely knack of, when you think a line, when you're thinking this poor Kevin, poor Kevin, poor Kevin, and then she gives you one more line about it, it makes him seem even more pathetic, and then you can't but laugh.
There's a
lot going on, and it's really hard to do it well, and she somehow does it well. To face up to like proper trauma and to have a little line that kind of self-deprecates, the narrator self-deprecating themselves can kind of, that can give you a little twist as well.
Yeah, and I think the humour also be the rhythm of this story and the way that there's kind of these punchlines, where you might not necessarily expect there to be a punchline. It kind of speaks to this, there's almost a stammer on my S's here, a staccato element of a prose, and it's kind of torrential in elements. It just kind of hits you. It just keeps coming, bang, 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 line down, line.
Yeah, absolutely. And there's something else actually as well that I think builds into that, right? And that is contradictions. That's something that I kind of had a note on myself, that she has a great way with contradictions. So a character feels giddy and ashamed, or there's a phrase, the joys of being used, as if it would be a joy to be used. There's one of my favourite lines, which is later in the story. She asks Kevin, I think, is my hair nice pulled back? And then the next question is, what have I done to deserve this life? You know, there's taking these wildly different statements or descriptions or describing something in a contradictory way, it gives you suddenly all this space to be surprised. And that surprise can often end with laughter, because you're thinking, this is so bad, but the joys of views, okay, like, it's a relief. That's what it is. It's relief. Yeah. That contrast, the sudden contrast in a certain phrase, the sudden contradiction of terms, gives you relief from otherwise what might be depthless sadness.
Yeah. At the end of the story, I mean, where is our narrator left? You know, it's like, I'm talking about relief, and this, because sadness or the comic, the tragic comic, it kind of like, how do you feel at the end of the story? And also, can you remember the first time when you got to the end of the story? How did you feel? And is it different on a second reading? You know, like, I have a lot of mixed feelings about, positive mixed feelings, I should add.
I think the first time, it's hard to remember, the first time I read the story, I remember thinking that she was turning a corner, this character is turning a corner. She's going to change the light bulb herself. She starts using her body. The body has been this detached thing all along, and then she uses her body to like force the fridge into the center of the garage interior. And I'm thinking she's doing it. Yeah. And then another plant turns up. And it's like, and you can see she's like glad the plant has arrived because that's a connection again. And that's something that she can hug until it disintegrates in her hands or whatever. And
something real, the plant as well, isn't it? It's something living.
Yeah. Like, here's another living thing for me to reach out and grab, and that will probably just wilt in my grasp. But here's another trauma, right? Yeah. And looking again at the last, so she falls.
Could we read us a final paragraph, actually?
Yeah, let's. Can I read two little sections, actually? Because there was one thing I just thought was so summing up of the story, right? Yeah. So this is probably at her lowest point. Kevin's been taken away from her. The plant, I think, has died. And there's this little piece that sums up her routine. I had taken to becoming a resigned passenger in cars that traversed the motorway. These were meaningless trips, but I did not sleep well after them. And there's this kind of thing in that, like, that she literally she's so detached now. She's just a passenger in a non-place, in a car on a motorway, going nowhere. It's not a journey anymore. It's just a passageway through to nothing, a meaningless trip. But then that kind of summed up everything I wanted to. It sums up everything about that story that you're feeling. It brings in the body, this detachment of the body, the notion of performative, because all the way through these characters are performing. And that, again, it goes back to something that might be generational. There's a performative aspect to almost every line, even the way she takes out contractions, like, they have gone that way. You're saying your line, not they've gone that way.
Yeah.
Like, it's really, really cleverly done. But so she's become this, I had taken to becoming a resigned passenger, you know, yeah. Like that was my role now. And then there's this furious turn, and you're thinking, yes, she's back. She's resolved to replace the light bulb. She has a daring project. She's going to do it. And just maybe I'll just cut to the very the last four lines. I tried to steady myself on the ladder while saying, whoa, whoa. I caught only the bright tip of the wire as that ladder slipped from underneath me. And as I went hurtling through, all the way through the cement floors, everything looked familiar and enchanting. And there's that contradiction again, familiar and enchanting, both everyday and totally fairy tale-esque or totally strange. Like that, I don't know what you would have, bring straight to mind Kafka, right? Mm. That's like taking something very sad and very serious and momentous, and relieving yourself of the ability to have to think about it too much, because it's just enchanting. It's just, and where is she falling? Yeah. Maybe is she falling back into the old routine? Is she falling back into a repeated trauma? Every reader will finish it differently. Maybe she's falling back to earth and she's coming back. And she, like, maybe the light bulb is her back. I resolved to do something. I gave myself a purpose again.
Yeah.
I could read it 10 more times and finish it five different ways, yeah. You know, a different way each time.
Yeah.
And
that's part of its, the beauty and the strength of it, that it defies one single interpretation.
Yeah, exactly. And that's just something, and that's what, it's the kind of story then that when you're asked a few years later, which story do you want to pick as your favourite, it just comes straight to your head like that. I still think about that story, you know?
Thank you, Danny Denton, for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
For the listeners at home, this is part of an ongoing series of podcasts. There'll be a new podcast each month available on our website. Also on our website, available to subscribers, is 20 years of archive of the magazine, where you can read every single piece we've ever published. I'd like to thank once more Danny Denton for joining us today, and we'd like to thank the Arts Council for their ongoing financial support. So that's it for now. In the meantime, don't forget to tune in to next month's podcast.